The Bad Apples, Episode 12, Season 3. My name is Klaatu, I'm the host of this show. If you're new to this show and you're thinking, that voice sounds familiar, you might know me from
Hacker Public Radio,
or
Linux Cranks,
or
Fedora Reloaded.
But yeah, this one is actually my show. This is my podcast, or my netcast. Anyway, in today's netcast, we will talk about putting your /var and your /home folder on separate partitions. Not really, I mean, I'll tell you how if you want to know how. It's pretty simple, but more like the reasoning behind it. And I shall also talk about open firmware, which is something that like three different people have kind of been asking me about lately. And it's you know, you wouldn't think it was that relevant anymore, but I mean, the computers with open firmware are still around, and still people are trying to put Linux onto them, so it is kind of something good to know, and it's kind of a neat, it's neat to talk about it anyway, because it is an interesting alternative to BIOS and EFI and things like that. So we'll talk about that, and I'll try to get to maybe some listener feedback or something if I can dig something up. And that'll probably about wrap her up. So let's get started. Okay, so a lot of times when you're installing a Linux disk or a Linux OS rather on your computer, you'll come across the portion of it that gives you the various partitioning suggestions. And some of the distros out there make it really easy. Some of them kind of make you do it all yourself. Some of them give you suggestions. Some of them give you a lot of suggestions. I know that Debian, because I just very recently installed Debian, but this was as a server install, and I don't remember if that was a specific, if it knew yet that I was doing a server install. I don't believe it did. So I think this is standard Debian procedure. One of their suggestions is a separate /var and a separate /home directory. And I used to think that this was very cool and interesting, and I didn't really know the reasoning behind it. I kind of gathered after a while that putting your /home on a separate partition could be a good idea, because if you're going to have to do some kind of reinstall of the entire system, you wouldn't necessarily have to. You should obviously back up the /home directory, obviously, but chances are good that you would install the system, and the system would be installed, but the /home directory would be on that other partition. Now, I've never actually reinstalled on a system that has been set up this way, so I don't know about the logistics of telling the computer that this is what you're doing. A lot of these the installers that I've seen seem to want to create a user for you from the installer stage, and it doesn't, at least from what I can tell, they don't ask you, here's, would you like to create a new user, or do you have one that you would already like to use? So I'm not too sure about how that's done. Now on Slackware, you'd be able to do that, because you create the users after you've actually installed. You actually log in order to create your users. So that I could see doing it on. I don't really know how the other distributions deal with it, because I've never had to do it. But the point is that the data is there. It is safe. It's separate from the system. But there's a security reason for all of this as well. And that's I think that's probably the best reason that I've heard so far, and that's probably the primary reason that people advise you to do this. Since having your /home on a separate partition, that does seem a little bit convenient for reinstalling. But number one, how often do you reinstall with all your data on a on a partition? You're going to back it up anyway, so I don't get the huge advantage there. But what I do see is the security aspect of it. And this, again, for us home users who basically just have a computer that we use, or three or four, and we're on the internet normally, just like normal people. We're not like serving files via the internet and stuff like that. This probably isn't that big of a deal, to be fair. But if you're doing a home server or, a web server, email server, whatever, you might want to take this into consideration. Now, first of all, let me just say that it's really cool, and I don't think everyone really grasps how cool it is, that Linux can have separate partitions for the components that create the system, I mean, like, it needs a /var, it needs a /home, it needs a swap, but you can have that all on separate partitions from the root directory, and it knows that. It knows to look on these separate partitions for that data, and that is really cool. That's a tribute to the flexibility of Linux, and I'm sure just plain vanilla, just the Unix philosophy or the Unix way of doing things. Very flexible, very cool, very modular. So that's neat. Anyway, security reasons behind all this. Apparently there are attacks out there, and my standard disclaimer is that I'm not a security expert by any means. I have no idea what I'm talking about, but I've read up on it, so I'm just sort of repeating what other people have told me, and it sounds very plausible to me. There are attacks out there that will essentially try to fill up your hard drive space. And actually, I think this happened to my dad once. He was running a Red Hat server, I believe, and this was his first server, first time with Linux. This was a couple of years ago now, sure enough, like, the system logs had gotten just filled up with I guess connections from outside or attempted connections from outside, things like that. And that the system log file, the /var/log or whatever it's in, it just got so filled up with denied requests and things like that, that it literally brought the hard drive to a stop. I mean, well, not literally, but it caused it so that the computer could no longer function because the hard drive was full, just no room left. No, not even enough room to think about, getting some of that information off on its own. So now that's a problem. And the problem there is that /var was on the same partition as the root directory, meaning that if someone is filling up the /var folder with stupid logs, then your entire system is going to be affected because it's on the same partition. Whereas if you give a couple of gigs over to a /var, if that becomes full, that's fine because the rest of the system is still chugging away with plenty of swap space, plenty of room to breathe for itself. It's not being affected by a filled /var partition. Same goes with the /home. People, I guess, if they do gain user access, they could theoretically try to flood, all the different user folders. I mean, in theory, they shouldn't even be able to get out of their own folder. And if you've set like some kind of disk quota, then that would be fine. They shouldn't be able to fill past their quota. But I think that we're talking about pretty sophisticated or somewhat sophisticated attacks. People can basically anything writable, right? Like, so /var and /home are both writable partition folders. People are going to be writing data to those on a regular basis. It's what they're for. Whereas the rest of the root, the rest of the system is not really being written to as much. It's containing data that's being read and used, all the binaries and the kernel image and things like that. So leaving that on its own partition leaves the core system safe and free of any kind of writing to it, unless you're installing a new application. Then obviously it's writing that out to your root partition in usr/bin or something like that. But for most kinds of, you know, Linux plausible
cranked,
attacks.
Linux cranked.
Everything being written is being written to a separate partition from your system, and so everything is safe, more or less, and everything should continue to operate even if, you know, someone is flooding, you know, some bot is flooding your system logs with, you know, denied requests or whatever they flood VAR folders with. And that's the reason. That is why you do it. The how, I mean, it's really simple. Like I say, on Debian, it literally suggests it for you. It says, hey, I see that you want to use this hard drive as a Linux drive. How about doing this? And I usually take them up on that offer. Again, I didn't really know why I was doing it. I just thought it sounded cool. Now I know why. So you can do that really easily on a Debian install. Now, I think, I mean, on the other ones, I haven't really installed anything other than Debian and Slackintosh lately, but I think on Ubuntu and Fedora, I don't think they make that suggestion for you, but you could go in there, you know, into their little graphical partitioner tool, and you could do it yourself, and it's just kind of up to you as to how many gigabytes you want to make each partition, you know, I mean, kind of think about how much data you think you want for your home directory and how much data you think you want for your system logs. Quote, a couple of gigs should be fine for the /var. That's what everyone seems to kind of agree on. So I guess that's a couple, like two or three. I mean, gigabytes are so, I mean, we've got so much hard drive space now. It's not really that much of a commodity. So, you know, you can probably throw two or three gigs at the /var and feel fine about it. Couple of gigs for your swap, you know, twice your RAM seems to be the rule of thumb, and then, you know, a good amount for your home and a little bit of extra room to play around with on your core system partition should be fine. And you can do that manually. Now in Slackware /Slackintosh, you would just go into like CFDisk or FDisk, whichever you are using, and again, you would just do it manually. Just delete all existing partitions and create a new partition map, and just, you know, define all of your separate partitions. Okay, so that was a nice little technical segment there, so let's branch off into a more of an opinion piece for a moment, and then we'll get back into the deep technical stuff with open firmware. So this is something I've been thinking about lately, piracy specifically, and it's interesting, the whole notion of, quote, piracy. First of all, piracy, for hundreds of years, hundreds of years, has meant a bunch of people riding around, you know, in boats or camels and lying in wait on either the open sea or on some road from one major city to another, lying in wait for someone to come by with goods that they would like to acquire, and then killing those people in order to take their goods. I think most of us here would agree that, morally speaking, it's wrong to do that. We might not agree on the motives behind, you know, what makes people do that, whether it's human nature or whether it's, you know, societal influence, but we'll say that that was what piracy was, right? Funny thing happened. From what I understand of it, it was around about the time of, you know, VCRs and things like that. Suddenly people started applying this term that had meant bloodthirsty killers previously to something like copying a videotape or a cassette tape and a cassette-to-cassette thing, you know, making mixtapes for your friend. Right there, semantically speaking, you know, that's that's what we would call an overkill. You know, it's kind of like saying that someone, you know, using Windows deserves to be shot or something like that. I mean, that is just overkill. And the thing is that it's not being used as a joke. You know, they're serious about the term piracy. When they talk about you have pirated that movie or you have pirated this software application, that is what they mean. They mean you have pirated. They're not saying that tongue in cheek. They actually are seeking and have pretty effectively applied that term, which has a very, very really serious connotation with it, you know, deep within our vocabulary, to something that has nothing to do with, you know, people dying over stuff or getting killed or fighting or anything like that. This is, in terms of scale, the completely opposite ends of the spectrum. All right, so that's my linguistic analysis of the term piracy. Like I said, it's not very technical. But I think it's significant because, and let's focus on just software, quote, piracy, unquote. You know, if you're copying a software application, let's say you just discovered, you know, Photoshop, and you're crazy about it. You think it's the bee's knees. You want to share it with someone. Now, they would say that is wrong, okay? Because they're proprietary, they being whoever they are. Adobe is a proprietary software company. They safeguard their code, you know, quite fiercely. And they will probably continue to safeguard that code. So you copying the software and not giving them their, you know, what is it, like $1,400 for the full version of CS4 now? It's like really, really expensive. I might be lowballing that. You're not giving them that money. They are feeling cheated. They feel like you've robbed them. Now, there again, piracy versus burglary, two different things in the mind, usually, because, you know, one is overtly attacking and killing people, and one is typically thought of as sneaking into a house and taking something. But anyway, I digress, back into linguistics. So they will tell you that that's wrong. Ignoring the fact that, and this is arguable, but I think that it seems to be, in my, you know, experience, it seems to be that there is a certain element of human nature, or in my opinion, it is human nature, to want to share with others. Now, I know that a lot of people are very greedy, and we don't seem like we want to share with others. But I think that if you look, I mean, if you really took someone away from all the stresses of everyday life and said, here's something really cool, even within the stresses of their daily life, I mean, their compulsion is to share it with people that they care about. At least people that they care about, if not everyone else. But they want to share it. You know, if you get something that you really like, whether it's an album of music or a software application that has changed your life, then one of the first things you want to do is you want to share it with a friend. You know, you say, hey, look, man, this is a really good album. You should hear it. Or you say, hey, look, this application makes, you know, it really easy to retouch photos or you know, cut video together or whatever. And you immediately want people to share that kind of delight with you. And this is why things like sites on the internet take off. You know, like someone discovers last.fm, immediately what they want to do is get their friends involved, you know, and that's how these things spread. Because people are excited about the services that they're getting from this particular website or whatever, and they bring their friends in, and suddenly you've got a phenomenon on your hand. And this is why, you know, I mean, in the Linux community, it's almost a no-brainer. I mean, that's practically the foundation of Linux, that sharing is a good thing, you know, that it benefits everyone. So there's that. But I mean, if you listen to the stuff that the Linux community produces, podcasts about, you know, a cool file manager, you know, DeepGeek did a Hacker Public Radio episode on a file manager called ROX, ROX. And it was such a great episode because you're listening to it and you're like, wow, this guy's talking about a file manager and he really likes it. And I mean, how often, you know, the Linux community does that. They break things down into little tiny components and they just get excited about things. I mean, I did a segment once on rsync, you know. I mean, it's a kind of a passion and interest for something, and one of the first things you do after you've explored it for yourself, you want to share it with others. Proprietary software, copyrights, the very idea of intellectual property, all of these things rob you and me of our real passion. You know, the passion to discover something neat and to share it with a friend. And I mean, if you think about it, they are even kind of setting you up to be what they will call a pirate, on a much lesser scale, you know, a thief. And that's what the whole proprietary model does. That it sets you up because it says, here's something cool, but you can't share it unless, you know, you can somehow get your friend to pay the same ridiculous amount of money that you had to spend on it. Now, I should probably digress for a moment and say, yeah, programmers need to make a living as well, and I understand that. And I'm not a programmer, and I understand that. But, you know, as 330, one of my co-hosts on the Linux Cranks podcast, often points out, free software does not necessarily mean that you cannot sell it. It simply means that it's free code. So I'm not saying that no one should ever purchase software, no one should ever donate, you know, money for the projects that they really, really love. In fact, I encourage it. And I'm thinking about doing some kind of Chess Griffin style, you know, fundraiser like he did around Christmas time every year on Linux Reality. He would have people donate to a specific project, and I think if they did, he would send them like a set of Linux Reality CDs or something like that. I don't really want to go to the trouble of compiling all the bad Apple stuff, and I don't think people really need it on CD anywho, but I'll probably come up with something else, you know, to sort of encourage people to donate. More on that later. So I realize that, you know, programmers do need to make money, and I'm not saying to steal, you know, software. That's not what I'm... If someone wants money for their software, they have every right to ask for that because they put work into it. Now, what I am saying is that these proprietary applications take it to the extreme. They safeguard their code. They're not helping. They're not contributing anything back to the technological community, except things maybe to emulate sometimes. But they're certainly not saying, "Well, here's how it's done, and here's how it's done efficiently." They're causing people to recreate, you know, to reinvent things. And in some cases, they're just being stupid. They're just establishing a stupid way of doing something that everyone's used to because it's the industry standard. And so if you try to deviate from it, people get confused and don't accept it. Don't say, oh, well, it can't be done this way because that's not how, you know, Photoshop does it, or that's not how Avid does it, or whatever. Now I'm going to go out, way, way out, so just bear with me. Think about this, right? Proprietary systems. Three steps to truly oppressing the user. Number one, establish the fear of punishment if a certain law is disobeyed. They do that pretty well. They've got organizations out there dedicated to bringing in the pirates, quote-unquote pirates. Number two, create an arbitrary and unjust law. Again, it's arguable, but in my belief, in the way I think, the idea of not being able to share applications, to share software, to share code, things like that, that seems fairly arbitrary and unjust to me. And I think a lot of the open source and free software advocates would agree with me. And since that's probably who's listening to this show, I'm not going to go into trying to justify that. apparently there's some guy named Richard Stallman. If you listen to what he says, he goes into it a lot. Number three, step three, now encourage people to break that law. And you can see where three leads, because now you're back at one, where they've threatened you with punishment if you actually do break the law. Now, why would they do this? Why would they encourage you to break a law when they've already threatened you with punishment if you disobey that law? Well, the reason is that when you give someone... This is actually a fairly common marketing technique. You give someone something and you market it as revolutionary and life-changing, right? Think about it, man. There are, if you think about the way that society treats, you know, for instance, drugs, right? Lots and lots of drugs are illegal. And yet you see on TV more and more advertisements for pharmaceuticals and things that apparently will change your life. You will be a happier, more energetic, more vibrant person if you take, you know, brand X of this pharmaceutical. But if you do these other kinds of drugs, then you're evil. I mean, it's the same concept. You know, it's like, tell them that they want something, and if they get it one way, it's evil, but if they get it your way, it's okay. Are you following me, or am I going way, way too far out? This makes for great coffee conversation, by the way. So even if you're just shaking your head right now, just trust me. Go take someone out to coffee and talk like this to them. As long as they're a geek, they'll dig this. This is good stuff. This is what I use on all the girls that I date. I'm just kidding. Okay, so back to my point, right? So the point was and is that Photoshop is, you know, just so great. It's going to help you become a better artist. It's going to make you a more beautiful model. It's going to make you, you know, more desirable in the job market. All this stuff, right? And you've just paid an arm and a leg for it. Well, how are you supposed to not share that with a friend? Some people would argue that if you withheld that from a friend, you're the evil person. You're not sharing something that's changing your life, that's making everything better. Right? You want your friend to become a better photographer or a better model. You want them to be a super cool graphic designer, you know? But it's illegal. So piracy, quote-unquote piracy, is not wrong at all. It's actually exactly right. It's exactly what we're supposed to be doing in more or less our natural state. That is to say, when we are being friends with someone and we're just being ourselves, all we want to do is improve things for each other and for ourselves. And the same thing applies to technology. We want technological advancement. We want things to get easier and better, cleaner and more efficient, all that other good stuff. So we want to share this kind of stuff. So this quote, software piracy, unquote, is, you know, in a sense, it is, quote, right. It is morally correct to share something that is improving your life. But the thing is, and this is where the hook comes, I'm not saying to go rip Adobe Photoshop and Apple Final Cut or iMovie or, whatever, and go post it on all the wares sites. No, not at all. In fact, I'm saying specifically do not do that. And it's not because of the laws that have been laid down and that you might get caught and you might get in trouble. Couldn't care less about that stuff. Although I do care deeply for you, dear listener. The fact is that the real catch here is that if you're supporting the... if you're supporting this proprietary system, then we are pushing it out into the mainstream. As GNU Linux users, if we go market wares and try to essentially we're being pushers for these systems. If we are distributing Photoshop, next time someone asks, "Do you have a copy of Photoshop?" instead of saying, "Yeah, man, I sure do. Meet me in the alley later today, and I'll, you know, we'll make the trade." say no. But you know what I do have is this great application called GIMP, the GNU Image Manipulation Program. It works on Windows, it works on Mac, and oh, by the way, it works on this great cool thing called Linux, but you know, whatever. It's free, you know, try it out. It's a really good alternative to Photoshop. That would be pushing and furthering the cause that we actually care about, rather than pushing applications that are sponsored by companies that we don't care about and that we don't really appreciate in any way. And now most of what I'm saying here comes from a from something that I had written a little bit earlier, and I got a comment from someone about what I had written, and he actually sums it up really well. Probably should have just read his comment and made this segment a lot shorter. But if he says, if little, this is by Freak Coder from BinRev, if little Jimmy pirates Photoshop when he's young, he'll grow up with the skills to use Photoshop and work for a company that will have to buy legit copies. So when companies change that software they consider industry standard, then I think regular users will start to change as well. So, and he's dead on. I mean, that's the idea. You know, you encourage people, this software is so great, you can have it at this price. In your mind, as a proprietary company, you write off the fact that a lot of people are going to be ripping it off, are going to be stealing it, making illegal copies. You know, do a couple of cursory things to try to keep people from doing that, so that not everyone can do it. You know, establish the serial number system, and you know, have it call home a couple of times. Try to scare people a little bit, just so that just not everyone can do it. So you know, your good law-abiding citizens are going to pay the exorbitant price, and the upgrade price, and then the next upgrade price, and then they'll just do a whole new version. You got them for life. The rebels, the quote-unquote rebels, are going to be ripping off the software, and eventually they're going to be working at a place that says, "Why, yes, of course we run Photoshop here. I'm so glad you know that program." Or, "Yes, we use Microsoft Office, and I'm glad you're familiar with it. Here's a legitimate copy now that you can use, you know, and we're paying a per seat license for it, and we've got, you know, hundreds of employees, so we're paying that much." I mean, you see exactly what it's doing. It's prepping everyone for an industry standard that is supporting the proprietary software system. So, i.e., ergo, don't support this proprietary system. Do not push that on people. Do not quote-unquote pirate. And you know what? While you're at it, don't pirate either. Don't actually go out into a boat and attack the Queen's ships or the Spanish Armada and take all their goods, because that, I'm telling you, that it seems attractive at first, but you live that life long enough, you end up on Tahiti with a hangover and rickets or scurvy even. So avoid that as well. You know what that music means to me? That music means that it's time for a coffee break. And how appropriate, because we've had so much conversation so far in this episode, that would be perfect for just, you know, hanging out with friends, talking about these concepts over coffee. So go get a cup of coffee. Don't go get your friends yet, unless you want them to come and listen to the rest of the show. But yeah, go get coffee, and we'll meet right back here for the rest of the episode 12. Alright, so the next segment I'm going to do, I admit, is a niche market. It's not something probably everyone is going to be totally into, but it is interesting if you like to hear geeky talk, and admittedly I really do. Like when Dave Yates did, it was actually his joke Halloween episode for Hacker Public Radio. If you ever heard that one, you should definitely, if you have not, you should hear it. But he starts out as if though it's just going to be a normal episode, and he's talking about how to install, you know, something, I forget what, like Apache or something, and he's just going on and on, you know, just, and you put this into this slash, you know, USR slash, or I guess it would be probably slash far slash, you know, www, and it's just so much geek speak that you can't even, like, it doesn't even sound like English to you know, to anyone else. I just love that. So if you like that kind of thing, this might really get you pretty excited. If not, you might just be interested in firmware, because that's what I'm going to be talking about. And if you're not interested in that, your media player probably has a fast forward button on it. If you're not familiar with how that works yet, you should get familiar with it and think about using it, because this is going to be open firmware. So open firmware, for those who might not know, is the firmware interface that Macintosh computers had on them prior to Apple's big switch to the Intel architecture. So and after approximately the first iMac. So from the very first iMac, which, you know, for a lot of people was the first Apple computer they'd ever even heard of, first iMac up until Intel, it was open firmware pretty much. And open firmware essentially is the BIOS of the computer. You could think of it that way. It's a method of speaking to your computer before you even get into the OS. Okay, so first of all, open firmware, I have to say, I prefer it quite a bit, I think, to EFI, which is the extensible firmware interface, I think, by Intel, which all the Apple computers use now. EFI I like less than OpenEFI, which is the open extensible firmware interface, which is being done, you know, obviously by some group of rebels who don't have any respect for proprietary software. But, you know, the bottom line, I think, is, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of this, but bottom line is that chip manufacturers are evil. And I know it sounds bizarre, but they are. They lock in the code, the firmware, into their little chips. They program it, typically in Windows. They write to the chips with little chip bakers that are powered by Windows. And they just make everyone's life difficult. I know quite a few people in the business of making computers lately. I've met a lot of people. And it turns out that a lot of complications arise just from those. From obviously, a computer is a, you know, a motherboard, and then or a logic board, depending on what you want to call it. And then you've got all the little chips that you slap on there, and they talk to each other, and they tell the computer what's going on, and then you get to go into your OS. Problem is that these chips don't exactly necessarily come with an instruction book, and like whatever little codes they're sending out across the motherboard, that really kind of need to make sense to each other and to the OS, they're not always well documented. It's not always something that you can figure out. And you'd think, well, you're a big computer manufacturer, can't you just call the chip guys up and say, hey, you know when your chip does that one thing, what's that all about? They just won't tell you. It's trade secret. They will not tell you exactly what you need to know in order to get everything to respond like you want it to respond, because they're afraid that if they let you know all of this stuff, I guess in theory, Apple would then, and I'm basing it on Apple because I'm talking about open firmware, but it could be anyone, Sony, HP, Toshiba, they could theoretically, you know, buy themselves up a chip manufacturing plant and just make their own chips, I guess. I mean, I guess that's the fear. The point is that, or maybe, you know, the information would get out to a competing chip manufacturer. They'd be like, oh, cool. So that's how they're doing that one nifty trick they do with battery life. Well, let's implement that on our chip and we'll sell better. So they're very, very secretive, very, very difficult to work with from what I understand. And the next time that you, you know, close your Linux laptop, you know, wanting it to go to sleep or something, and it doesn't, or it doesn't wake up afterwards, file a bug, but don't call up, you know, don't start ranting about the Linux devs. Trust me, it's not the Linux people doing this. Call up the chip manufacturers, you know, if you can, or email them or something, or even call or email, you know, HP or Sony or Apple or Toshiba or IBM, whoever, you know, the manufacturer is, Lenovo, I mean, and tell them what's going on. Because, I mean, if these proprietary software companies And these computer manufacturers, you know, which I mean, Sony, I would call fairly proprietary, you know, and Apple, very proprietary. You know, they're making these computers and they're putting all their stuff on it and they're marketing it under their brand name. They're selling money. They're selling computers and they're making money. They should be able to lean on these chip manufacturers and say, "No, look, what we're going to have to demand here is a little bit more openness and a little bit less closedness, and that way we can all see what needs to happen so that this thing works." Because I mean, to this day, there are computers that you will buy from the store, and one, you know, you'll update some software or something, and you know, you'll have issues putting that computer to sleep or waking it up, or maybe it'll go into hibernation when you actually wanted it to sleep, and just weird things like that. It's not an exact science when, you know, it really ought to be. I mean, it's all code that people are putting on. It doesn't get there by itself, you know. So that was the rant. Now for the lesson. It's not really a lesson. So open firmware, you can get to it on a pre-Intel computer. If you're going to put, we're assuming you're going to put Linux on here, you might want to go into open firmware because you don't have the nifty little tricks that, for instance, the software that came on the computer has available to you, specifically something called NVRAM. I mean, there is NVRAM, but then there's a program called NVRAM, and you can put in variables and write to the non-volatile RAM on that computer. So if you can't do that because you're not running OS 10, then one thing you may want to do is go into open firmware and get the same job done, different interface. So you can get into open firmware pretty easily. You power on the PowerPC Macintosh whilst holding down Apple Option OF as an open firmware. A big scary white screen appears. Black text. It looks like a Unix shell, but it's not, and it doesn't really act that much like one. And this is all sort of, from what I understand, this is Sun Microsystems' implementation of open firmware. They might have invented it for all I know. I do not know. You can still find documentation on open firmware on Sun's site. So if you are a programmer and just wanting to start hacking around in open firmware, that would be the place to start. So let's see, the first thing that you could do, and this is something that I've used a couple of times, is to find out what is on certain bus locations. Yeah, I don't know if that's a real term, but bus locations, like where does the hard drive exist exactly? What bus is that on? And where does the CD drive exist? Things like that. The command for that is dev alias, devalias. That will list everything that the open firmware is aware of, and also tell you where on the motherboard it is attached. Now, you can probably guess why this would be handy. If you've got a computer that you are trying to boot up and it simply will not boot into an OS, or maybe you're trying to install something and it doesn't seem to see, you know, a hard drive or whatever, you might want to crack open firmware and really see what the computer think, what, you know, before the OS gets to it, what does the computer think it has? And then that can help you identify, you know, potential problems. It certainly helped me back in season 2 when I was, or season 1, whenever I did the iBook project where I took like two iBooks and had to figure out, you know, what parts were good on each iBook so that I could then combine them together to make one good iBook. Open firmware was the tool that told me the information, you know, that I could not glean from an OS because I couldn't get into an OS. So you've got dev alias, that's just a list. You can see what variables are set. So this would be like the NVRAM settings, the variables that have been written into non-volatile RAM. So this is the RAM that stays powered, you know, by an onboard battery or whatever, or maybe it's writing it to a chip and so it doesn't go away. I don't know, but it's non-volatile RAM, so it can be read and written to, but it maintains its knowledge after you power the machine down. Again, now if you're running OS 10, which you shouldn't be, if you're listening to this show, you can, well, unless you work around Macs like me, then I guess I guess you are. But if you are, you could always just do, you know, sudo nvram, and then variable, and then value. Simple enough. You can write anything there. It doesn't even have to be something that it knows. You can just, in foo, bar, you know, sudo nvram, foo equals bar, bang. It's in nvram now. Won't do anything with it, but it's there. While other variables will do something. So to do this outside of an OS, since you don't have nvram as an application on your Linux OS, you can go into Open Firmware and you type in dev, D-E-V, for device, space, slash option, space, dot properties. Now that is going to list all the variables available to you. And it's a really long list. And there are things like, I mean, let's say you've got Linux on there, right? And you want to add your own OEM banner. Like, you know, welcome to, you know, Klaatu's Linux. Email me at Klaatu at linuxcranks.info or whatever. You could do that. You can set those variables here. And the way that you set it is you do a set env, set env, set env, set env space boot-device. Well, okay, if you're doing OEM banner, it would be set env space, I think it's OEM-banner space value, whatever it would be. So if I wanted to say, you know, hello, welcome to Klaatu's Linux, it'd be set env space boot OEM-banner space, I think, single quote, Klaatu's Linux, or welcome to Klaatu's Linux, finish single quote. I think it's a single quote. I wouldn't swear to it. I haven't done it in a while, but, you know, you're getting the syntax. Set env space boot-device space enet. That would set your boot device as your Ethernet port. Pretty fancy, right? So if you've got, like, some kind of Pixie server set up, this would be a great way to ensure that your Mac boots off the internet, the Ethernet device. Now, you can also do that with a snag key, i.e. holding down the in key while you're booting, but this is another way of doing that. And like I say, there are some things that you can't do, you know, with snag keys or anything like that, so, you know, there are other things that you can do. When something is done successfully in Open Firmware, it returns an OK at the end of the same line that you typed. It doesn't give you a new line, doesn't make a big deal, it just says OK. I have had, I'm almost positive, I've had instances where it says OK, meaning that it didn't find a particular error in what you've done, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that you did the right thing. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I think it was a boot-device variable setting. Set on space boot-device space. I think I did it like to CD or something. And for whatever reason, it didn't pick up that variable or something. Or maybe the CD drive was broken. But I seem to recall a point where I was able to put in a value that I guess it didn't have a problem with, but at the same time didn't really have any meaning to the computer, so that when I rebooted, it didn't really change anything. So just be aware of that. You can double check to see that the variable has been set. If you know if the OK isn't enough for you, just again type in dev space slash options space dash properties, and that will give you the long list, and you can kind of verify with your own eyes that that has been exactly set. Now, if you are doing like an Ethernet install or something, or you know from a server, a Pixie server or whatever, you know, again, you can always hold down the option key while you're booting, but the other way, if you want to be very specific about where you want to boot from, if it's a multiple server environment, maybe you've got a couple of boot images, you can specify very clearly as to what exactly you want it to boot from. So you would just say boot space enet colon, and then it would be the IP address of the server containing the Linux boot image. So let's just say it's 192.168.1.4, and then you do a comma, and then the file name of whatever the Linux boot image would be. Now, I don't know enough about booting off of these servers and stuff to know exactly even what to give you as an example. For that, you'd have to research doing your own Pixie server. I've got no experience doing that. Someday I will, and I will share. But it would be the boot image anyway. And then you do a comma, your local machine's address. So that's this guy right here that you're using. And so that would be, let's say, 192.168.1.3. and then a semicolon, and then the subnet mask, so it's probably 255:255:255:0, unless you've specifically changed it, and then a semicolon again, and then the gateway address, if that applies, I guess, 192.168.1.1, let's say. I guess it would have to apply, because I assume that would be like the router getting the two IP addresses talking to each other. I'm not sure. Like I said, I've never done it, so but this is where you would set the specific file from the specific server that you would want this thing to boot off of. So that's very good to know. Another nifty trick is to telnet into open firmware. Now, again, I haven't really had any success getting much done via telnet into open firmware, although I can get a open firmware prompt in my bash shell, so I gain the advantage right there of handy things like copy and paste and being able to scroll up the up a very long list, things like that. But to do that, you simply type dev space slash packages slash telnet, and as long as that version of open firmware has telnet available to it, it'll respond with that little OK. And then you type in very, very specifically, double quote, space, enet, colon, telnet, comma, and then the IP address that you want to give that computer. So as long as your local area network has that IP address available to it, you know, it's not being taken by some other machine, then you can type it in, 192.168.33.33, let's say, close quotes, space, IO. And you hit return. And then the computer gives you an OK, I'm pretty sure it does, and then it just kind of sits there, and it looks like it has crashed. It really is going to look like it's crashed. You're going to be like, oh, that didn't work. Yeah, it did work. So now go over to your other machine and go ahead and telnet into it. Simply, you know, open a terminal, telnet space 192.168.33.33. Suddenly you're talking the wonderful language of open firmware, and you've got all your open firmware commands that you can do and things like that. Now, I tried, you know, utilizing this somehow with installing Linux. Didn't work for me at all. I tried setting variables. That, I mean, well, once you're in there, it's pretty much, it's just like being in open firmware. So everything you do normally works as expected. And then you have to type in, I think, mac-boot or mac-reboot or something like that to reboot the machine after all your settings are set. But in terms of like utilizing this for an install, I've had no success whatsoever. So that's just an FYI. And once I have success, you will be the first to know about it, I assure you. I mean, I'm not even sure if that's the right place to be trying that. I have no experience installing stuff over a network, really. I do not. Except, like, you know, a Debian install, a net install, that counts. But it's not, there's not a whole lot for me to be doing at that point. It's not like I set up the server or anything. So the point of open firmware, of course, you know, is that you do have access, regardless of OS, to certain variables and certain information that the computer is holding and that you can now access, which is great. It's really nice. So if you've got Linux on there, you've got you need to set some variables or something like that. You need to check, you know, verify some hardware or something like that. Use open firmware if it's a PowerPC machine. And, you know, these PC machines are good machines. A lot of them are still really, you know, they're, if you see one, grab it, is what I'm trying to say. They're good machines. They run Slackintosh and Debian and Fedora really well. I've done all of those, and Yellow Dog. I've done all of those distros on, you know, one PowerPC or another. Sometimes you might hit a roadblock. There might be something a little bit wonky. Don't panic. Try a different distro. You know, that's one of the first things that I do. If Debian won't install on something, okay, set that aside, try Slackintosh. That won't do it. Set that aside, try Fedora. That won't do it. Try Yellow Dog. You know, try different ones. Obviously, try different media. Don't forget that at one point in this world, not all computers had DVD-ROMs. They only had CD-ROMs. So, you know, if you've got that, keep that in mind. You know, try an external CD drive if maybe it's just that CD isn't that CD reader isn't working anymore. Things like that. I mean, a lot of people are trying to rescue a lot of these old machines. I mean, especially the old iMacs. They're kind of, I mean, there were just so many sold that there are really quite a few of them now out there waiting for Linux to be installed on them. And, you know, if all else fails, email me. I'll try to help you in whatever way I can. But hopefully this has given you some information about, you know, other options that you have in terms of being able to communicate with that computer. And also let you have your fix of some really obscure geek talk. That music. That's the end theme. Wow, I had listener feedback and a couple of other things to talk about, but what can you do? When the end theme plays, you can't argue. So this has been episode 12 of The Bad Apples of season 3. I have been your host, Klaatu. Music is, as always, by Fat Chance Lester. You can contact me at klaatu@linuxcranks.info. Or if you must, use my old email address, gort.klaatu@gmail.com. You can contact me, or you can go to the website at thebadapples.info.
Pickle lovers always insist on the proud pickle.